Katie said shortly. It had taken only 20 short years to take Tyr's good town and turn it into a wreck. All Roe had needed was a church and, perversely, a lack of faith. She could believe anything now. She tipped her head back against the wall, closing her eyes. Somehow it was easier to bear the darkness that way. How did your father beat them?
He didn't.
He tried, but in the end he had no choice but to run away. They called it the crossing, but in reality it was nothing but a retreat. And now that's failed too. His voice was bleak, so bleak that it arrowed straight down to Katie's core and seemed to slice her open. She groped for his hand in the dark, twining his fingers with hers. Don't be a prat.
I'm not.
Jonathan's voice suddenly strengthened, as though he had resolved something.
I need you to do something for me.
What? There was a clink of metal in the darkness, and then Katie jumped as she felt something slither against her neck. A heavy chunk of stone tumbling down her breastbone.
What are you doing?
I'm giving it to you.
Why?
Because you're tougher than I was. You always were.
Jonathan's voice was bitter in the darkness.
You'll take much longer to break.
Neither of us will break.
I will.
Jonathan's hand clasped hers. We're out of options. It's better than nothing. Katie made a face. The Tyrs were pragmatists, they always had been, but she couldn't help longing for something better. Not a compromise, but a silver bullet, the holy grail of government. Where was it, that one perfect thing? She felt that if she could only find it, she would be willing to spend her life working to make it fire.
Fine words in a dungeon.
Jonathan's voice mocked her. Katie frowned, then leaned her head back again. It was time to wait, to clear her head, to prepare for the moment when her oldest and closest friend would come through the door, carrying a knife meant for her. Time drifted. Hours, days perhaps, Katie couldn't see. Sometimes she slept on Jonathan's shoulder, sometimes he on hers. Sometimes she woke in the dark with no memory of where she was, and then she would feel Jonathan's hand in hers and realize that it hardly mattered whether they were in a dungeon or in a clearing, in the town or outside it. They were together, the two of them, united in purpose, and that brought them 1,000 times closer than they had ever been. So close that when Jonathan's hand slipped beneath her shirt and Katie climbed into his lap, it seemed almost an afterthought. Natural outgrowth of a place they had already been, not love, but something 1,000 times more powerful. And when Jonathan entered her, yanking her hair back to expose her throat, Katie almost shrieked with pleasure. And when the sapphire at her throat began to glow, illuminating both Jonathan's face and her own, she saw that he was not entirely himself, that he too was in the hands of something else, and then she forgot as her mind stuttered and then fired, thinking over and over, "Now we are together. Now we are one." When it was over, they dozed. Jonathan said nothing, and neither did Katie. But she didn't think either of them were really sleeping. They were each waiting, preparing in their own ways for that ultimate moment. The click of the lock, and the opening of the door. Chapter 14. The Great Gamble. When the invasion of New London finally came,
It was very different from what anyone had imagined. More than 1,000 Mort soldiers entered the defenseless city, looting and burning as they came, and of these, 500 went on to lay siege to the keep. The Holy Father had hired these troops, and, as later evidence revealed, had gone to great expense to transport them in secret. But as is so often the case in the hiring of mercenaries, the outcome reached was not the outcome sought. The Mort felt badly used, and they came not only for wealth, but for blood and revenge. The carnage can only be estimated, for few were left alive to chronicle it, and none of these able to write. The Tierling as a military nation, Callow the Martyr. Staring up at her city, Kelsey felt a curious sense of doubling. She was looking at New London, a place she knew well, the cluster of houses on hills, the grey fortress of the keep, the white tower of the Arvath. All of these things were familiar. But at the same time, she couldn't help seeing the city through Katie's eyes, as a vast cancer of ruined potential. Knowing what New London had been meant to be made it much worse to see what it had become. The western side of the city was aflame. Even from here at the base of the southwestern slope, Kelsey could hear the screams as people fled the fire, but she didn't deceive herself that the fire was the only problem. The Mort were loose in her city. There was no wall on the western side, and it was an easy climb up the hill to the base neighborhood, the Lower Bend. But Kelsey didn't know where to begin. She was surrounded by armed men, Hall and the remainder of his army as well as her guard, but they weren't enough. She couldn't retake her city by force.
"Majesty,"
Mace muttered urgently. She turned south toward the vast dust cloud that had been following them for the last day. At first it had been small, little more than a slight disturbance of air on the horizon, but in the past few hours it had resolved itself into a wide, dusty haze spread across the lower Almont. Her guard had kept an uneasy eye behind them, but there had been no time to stop. Kelsey turned to the Fetch and found him watching her, his eyes wide and hopeless. "Is he coming for you?" she asked.
"No, Tear Queen. For you."
"What are you jabbering about?" Elston asked. "Speak sense. What is that?"
"The Orphan."
"The Orphan is a children's fable,"
Dyer protested. "Hush, Dyer." She paused, suddenly struck by a thought, and moved over to crouch beside the Fetch. What really happened to Roe, after Jonathan died?
"Cursed. We didn't know Katie had Jonathan's magic until after Jonathan was dead, and once we found out, even Roe didn't dare touch her. She fled, but first she cursed us all."
The Fetch gestured to the four men around him, who nodded unhappily, then turned his doomed eyes back to the dust cloud behind him.
"She cursed us as traitors, and we still pay and pay."
"What about Roe?"
"I don't know what Katie did to him. Roe began to fade, and then he simply disappeared. The town fell into warring factions, tore itself apart. Half of the population struck out eastward across the plains. It was only years later that we found out Roe wasn't dead, but in the Fairwitch."
"And I let him loose," Kelsey murmured. She needed no spyglass to see them now. a horde of small dark forms running on all fours, advancing north across the plains. Had she led them to her city, or had they been coming here all along? She didn't know, but it hardly seemed to matter any longer. She had no answer for the tide below. No answer in the present, anyway. She didn't understand what Roe Finn had become, but she didn't believe he could be beaten here. This problem, like so many, began in the past, and it was too late to fix.
Lady,
Mace repeated,
we must move. Now.
Kelsey nodded, then looked back up the hill. The immediate problem was up there. She needed to get into her keep, but pandemonium reigned. Her city was overtaken with violence, which left Kelsey back where she had been all along. She dug into her pocket and brought out Rose Sapphire. The blue facet sparkled in the dying light, and again Kelsey had the uncomfortable feeling that the jewel was winking at her, almost daring her to put it on. What choice did I ever have? She wondered. Carlin raised me to eschew force, but this world is ruled by force. It's too late for anything else. She turned to her guard, who were clustered around her on the hillside. General Hall and his twin brother were there, too, though Hall's sorry band of soldiers waited several hundred feet down the slope. Even Ewan was here, having doggedly insisted on following them to the city. Kelsey thought that Bradshaw had taken Ewan on his horse, but she could not be sure of anything about that journey. Too many miles had been spent in the twilight of Katie's mind. But now she could regret, at the end, that Ewan was with them. She wished he would have stayed behind, stayed safe. She wished she could have kept them all safe, her guard, her country. Wished she could have wrapped them away and hidden them in the past, or perhaps the future, anywhere but the present. She dangled the necklace from her fingers, watching the light play across the chain. Force, she thought. Force is what's left when all other options are exhausted. Even Carlin must have known that. We're going up there, she told them. To the keep. Your first instinct will be to protect me, I know.
Here it comes,
Dire muttered. But do me a favor and protect each other. Understand, Dire?
Yes, lady, yes. Because that's what I signed up for. To guard other guards while I leave the Queen to her own devices.
She glared at him for a moment, but found that she could not maintain it. After a moment, she shook her head and continued, "Smart mouths aside, I mean what I say. I don't know what will happen when I put this on." She held up the sapphire. "But it can't be the safest thing in the world. I may not be myself. I may be..." "The Queen of Spades." She swallowed. "I want you all to stay out of my way. Agreed?" None of her guard would meet her eye, except for Mace, who raised his eyebrow expressively. "I mean it."
"Are we going to go?" Elston asked, "or are we going to wait for those things out there to come up and kiss us on the mouth?"
Kelsey glanced behind her and saw that the tide of children had nearly reached the base of the hill. Taking a deep breath, she put on the second necklace, and, as it settled between her breasts, she felt a horrible comfort there. The comfort of coming back to a house that had long since been wrecked, but which was, nevertheless, home. "Come on," she told them, and scrambled up the hill, not waiting to see whether they would follow.
"Now,"
Isha breathed, and Father Tyler nodded. Together, they shoved at the grating over their heads. It was heavy, solid iron, but Isha could feel some give. If they had been strong men, there would have been no problem. But Father Tyler was as frail as ever, and Isha's body was racked with fever. Her wounded arm felt as though it had been shot through with veins of molten iron. They pushed until Isha's entire back ached, but still only revealed a quarter crescent of deep evening blue sky.
"That's something anyway," Isha muttered. "A few minutes and we'll try..."
She fell silent, listening.
"Is it them?"
Father Tyler whispered, but Isha put a hand on his wrist to keep him quiet. She thought she had heard something in the tunnel below, the scrape of a boot on stone.
"Again,"
she panted. "Quick." The two of them grasped the edge of the cover and shoved. Bright lights danced before Isha's eyes, but the cover was halfway off now. Starlight illuminated the edges of the ladder upon which they perched, and for a moment Isha felt her balance waver, felt as though she would simply fall, not into the tunnel she had just climbed out of, but into a darkness deeper than any she had ever known.
"I can squeeze out,"
Father Tyler murmured. He clambered a few more feet up the ladder, snaking his thin body through the half-moon opening, then boosted himself up and out. The beaten leather satchel he carried with him gonged against the top of the ladder, and Isha winced. No one in the tunnels below could fail to hear that sound. Isha had given the Caden the slip several days ago, vanishing into a deep crevice in the main tunnel while they walked ahead. It had not been an easy decision, for she felt a great deal of loyalty to these four men. But her loyalty to the Queen was stronger, and she knew that the Queen would have wanted Father Tyler back safe in the keep. She had thought it would be a relatively quick and simple business, fetch Father Tyler from his hidden alcove, smuggle him up to the keep, and then come back down with no one the wiser. She could claim that she had gotten lost in the tunnels for a day or so, very neat, very easy. She had forgotten that the Caden were not fools. In hindsight, she realized that they must have known something was up from the very moment she had discovered Father Tyler. She had felt uneasy leaving him down there, and her worry must have showed. When she slipped them, they had not gone on up the tunnel as she had thought, but had waited, hiding, to see where she would go and what she would do. It was only this morning that she began to suspect that she and Father Tyler were being tracked through the tunnels, and by that point, it was too late to make an alternate plan. They were on the southern edge of the gut, an area of the labyrinth that Isha did not know well and could not navigate with any skill. It seemed their best hope to get up and outside, but this too presented dangers, and they had been forced to wait until dark. As soon as Father Tyler was up and out, he resumed shoving the manhole cover. His leverage was better now, and even on his own he was able to move the iron disc well out of the way. He reached down into the hole.
"Come, child, boost yourself up."
Isha did. She usually resented being called child, but somehow coming from the old priest it didn't irk. She took his hands and bent her knees, preparing to spring upward, then shrieked as a hand clutched her ankle.
"Where do you think you're going, girl?"
Kicking frantically, she peered downward and saw the dim white circle of Daniel's face. Her kicks were ineffective. His hand on her ankle was like iron. Again she thought of simply letting go. She was close to death, had been so for days. Only concern for the priest kept her fighting that grim spectre off.
"We gave you a clean shot, girl,"
Daniel hissed. "And how do you reward us? That's a 10,000-pound bounty you're trying to hold for yourself."
"I'm not after a bounty," she panted.
Daniel's face moved closer, and she realized, alarmed, that he was climbing the ladder beneath her. His other hand had encircled her calf, squeezing until she squealed.
"We're a guild, you little cheat. No one holds back money from the guild."
"That's a lie," she gasped. "You did. They told me. Lady Cross. You let her go and kept the money and they threw you out." Daniel gaped at her, and in that moment Father Tyler leaned over the edge of the hole and swung his satchel in a short, sharp arc. The business end of the bag thumped Daniel in the face, and he fell, howling, from the ladder.
"Come, child," Father Tyler cried. "Now!"
Isha took his hands and let him pull her up from the hole. She saw immediately that she had misjudged their position. They were not in the gut any longer, but on the edge of the lower bend. She could find her bearings here easily, but they were at least a mile from the keep lawn. It was too far. She could barely walk, let alone run. Her arm was a dangling web of agony. From the hole at her feet came a string of curses, then the deep, gonging sound of boots climbing the ladder.
"Child, we must go."
Father Tyler grabbed her good arm and pulled her along. Isha blinked, half blind with pain and fever, seeing little, hearing a deep voice inside her head long ago. A father's voice, but not Dar's.
"Pain,"
she whispered to the priest, covering her eyes as the brightly lit windows passed by them, an endless panoply.
"Pain, only..."
Her legs tangled and she began to collapse. A moment later, though she barely felt it, the priest had picked her up and begun to run with her in his arms. Each step made Isha feel as though her head would split open. But she thought Father Tyler must know where he was going, for he darted down a nearby alley, then another, wending his way carefully around the edge of the gut, heading for the center of the city. Javel was hungry. He could feel the hunger, like a rock, deep inside his stomach, a gnawing, cloying sort of pain, so closely aligned with nausea that sometimes he could not tell the difference. For a while the pain went away, and he forgot it completely. But all it took was one whiff of food, and hunger came surging back. They had already begun to ration the provisions, and now, no matter how hard the gate guard worked, they were down to 2 small meals a day. The keep was still relatively well stocked from the Mort invasion, and, if needed, the food would last for a long time. But siege was siege. After a long fight, they had finally succeeded in getting the keep gate closed, bolstering it with wooden bars. In a brave move, Vil had led a small force down the wall and onto the drawbridge, laying a wall of bricks on the bridge while the Mort slept, so that by the time they woke, the mortar had hardened into a real obstacle. But yesterday, the Mort had broken the wall and gone to work on the gate. The wood reinforcements were gradually weakening, but Vil did not seem perturbed. He was acting true to form, as a hero, not thinking of himself but of the people upstairs, the women and children trapped in the keep. Vil might be a hero, but Javel was frightened. From time to time, Vil would take 2 or 3 gate guards up to the balconies on the higher floors, where they could look out over the city. There was nothing good to see. As many Mort as swarmed below on the lawn and the drawbridge, there seemed to be twice as many out in the city proper, setting fires, carrying off goods, and much, much worse. Javel didn't want to watch, but he seemed unable to help himself. The vantage was too good, and the sound of screaming carried easily across the lawn. But today the view was mercifully hazy, obscured by smoke from the fire that burned across the western skyline of the city.
"If only that fire would travel over this way," Martin remarked. "They've got oil down there and nowhere to dump it."
"Fire would be just as bad for us," said Vil. "Too much wood in here. The bridge is wood."
Javel kept silent. The idea of being trapped in here, fire ringing them all around, was too terrible to contemplate. He wondered, for perhaps the 100th time, why he couldn't have been born brave like the men around him. What good had his cowardice ever done anyone? Ali's face, set with contempt, flashed before him, and he closed his eyes as though he could somehow retreat from her gaze.
"Has the Holy Father shown up today?"
Vil asked. "Not yet," Martin replied, "but he'll be here. These are his troops. The Queen should charge him with treason."
"What Queen? Is there a Queen here?"
"I only meant..."
"I know what you meant,"
Vil replied tiredly.
"Enough. Let's go down. We need some sleep."
But when they reached the ground floor, they found not quiet, but a raging argument in front of the gate. The entire gate guard toe-to-toe with a group of Queen's guards and a woman Javel recognized easily. Andalai, the Queen's witch. At her side, holding her hand, was the same tiny girl who had spoken to Javel before. He shivered at the sight of them.
"What is this?"
Vil demanded.
"Why aren't you at your posts?"
"The woman, sir," Ethan replied. "She insists that we open the gate."
Vil turned to Andalai, his gaze uneasy.
"Nonsense."
"The Queen is coming," she replied. "Open the gate."
One of the Queen's guards moved forward, the same archer that Javel had noticed before. He was little more than a boy, but his posture was so combative that Vil actually moved back a step.
"The mace left Andalai in charge," the archer snapped. "Open the gate."
He shoved Vil, and Vil fell backward. Marco and Jeremy drew swords, but they found themselves facing more than 20 Queen's guards, all of them armed to the teeth. Javel considered the men before them for a long moment, but he was not seeing them. Instead, he saw a tall woman sitting astride a horse, a woman of many sorrows, with a crown on her head. In his mind, he heard the shrieks of women and children.
"It would take a brave man to open the door," Dyer's voice whispered.
"Are you brave, Javel?" Ali, her voice neither cruel nor kind, honestly doubtful. And last of all, the Queen's voice, long ago in the keep. "Don't you want to find out?" Javel did. A moment later, he had turned to the doors behind him and begun to attack the bolsters in a frenzy, dragging down one wooden plank at a time. Hands were on his shoulders, pulling him backward, but eventually they stopped, and he realized, gratefully, that other hands were helping him. Many hands, dragging down the enormous planks of wood from the stack, slowly revealing the thick oak of the keep gate. The Arvath was the first building to fall. It fell quickly, so quickly that Kelsey almost felt cheated. She had wanted to see the Holy Father's house drop piece by piece, the white stone first cracking, then peeling, then dropping in great chunks, the way snow fell from trees during the first good spring melt. She wanted to see the thing crumble. But the fall was very quick. She had no more than turned her mind to that rising white spire than wide cracks travelled its circumference, cracks so thick that Kelsey could even see them from here. The gleaming cross at the top went first, plummeting from the pinnacle, and within 10 seconds the entire building had gone down in a tornado of dust. Cheat or not, it was still very good. Only now did Kelsey realize how much of herself she had given away during the past few months, how much of her personality had been dead, dampened beneath the rigid control she had imposed upon herself in order to survive in the dungeon. Everything had been painted in shades of grey down there. and there had been no percentage in letting her temper out, letting it romp. She wondered whether she had nearly gone mad, whether she would even have noticed if she had crossed the border and sunk into insanity. Maybe it would only have seemed like the next phase. It didn't matter. Now she was free. Dimly, she sensed her guard around her, following her lead as she led them through the city. They were running, all of them, for Roe Finn's creatures were right behind them, and now Kelsey could almost sense the man himself, not far back, all of his attention focused upon her. Sometimes she thought she could even feel his eyes. Several times her guards stopped to loose arrows into the street behind them, but Kelsey knew they would hit nothing. Roe's children were too quick. They crossed the circus, and Kelsey sensed, rather than saw, people scattering from her path. They didn't seem to matter, all of these people. Their problems were so small. Kelsey sensed them as she flew by. Problems with spouses, with money, with drink. They should scatter, she thought grimly, as though this journey were an argument in which she had been somehow vindicated. They should scatter. I'm the Queen of Spades. They circled around the outside of the gut, where the houses and buildings descended into a valley, the cup between two hills. Once upon a time, this depression had held an amphitheatre where William Tyr's utopians would meet and decide things by popular vote. Democracy in action. But not really. Behind everything had been Tyr, always Tyr, and when that driving force was gone, the town had nothing, left open to the lowest common denominator. Leadership was all that stood between democracy and the mob. As they crossed the gut, Kelsey sensed the creche beneath, a great anthill of chambers and tunnels built God knew when. Thinking of that deep dungeon sunk in the earth, Kelsey wondered if the creche had been built by Roe himself. Who knew what he might have accomplished in the dark? If only I could stop it, she thought, the thought now so familiar that it seemed to run a set course, a well-worn groove in her mind. If only anyone could have stopped it. As they began to leave the gut behind, Kelsey sent a massive crack running through the earth, just as she had done when she cracked the new London Bridge all those months ago. The street beneath her trembled, but she didn't stay to watch the effects of her handiwork. She knew how it would go, could predict it as surely as Simon could predict the operation of one of his many machines. The crack would travel deep, all the way down through that warren of tunnels where the dark heart of New London lived. Struts would collapse, foundations would sink, even the streets themselves would begin to tumble into the fissure she had made. It might take hours or days, but eventually the gut, the creche, these would be nothing more than an archaeology site, infinite layers of wood and stone for someone to excavate in the distant future.
"Lady, no!" Mace shouted. "The girl, Isha!"
Kelsey shrugged that off, annoyed at his interference. What possible value could one life hold against the vast expanse of pain that had gone on beneath these streets? Perhaps, given enough time, the entire city would fall through a hole in the earth, settling into so much detritus. That outcome seemed entirely right. How could you rebuild on a broken foundation? They would have to wipe it clean and start over. That's Roe talking. The voice was Katie's, but Kelsey shrugged it off as well. Rebuilding could come later. Now she wanted only to punish. Down the great boulevard where people scattered before her approach, she made eye contact with a woman standing in front of a milliner's, and the woman began to scream. "What do they see?" Kelsey wondered. She turned, meaning to ask Mace, but he was nowhere to be seen. 20 feet behind her, Elston was struggling with several men in the black uniforms of the Mort army. "Mort," she thought bemusedly. "Here."
She turned her attention to the Mort soldiers and they dropped to the ground, the chests of their uniforms darkening with blood. The rest of her guard was still with her, but Kelsey couldn't help noticing that they did not look at her, that they worked hard to keep their eyes elsewhere. No one had ever liked the Queen of Spades. Not Mace, not her guards, not anyone. The sapphire throbbed against her skin, and now she could feel Ro Finn inside her head, his long life a seemingly endless accumulation of experiences, no time to linger on a single one. But she saw her own pudgy fingers playing with jacks on wooden floorboards. Her worthless mother sitting at the table, weeping by candlelight. And Kelsey stared up at the woman and felt something that was almost hatred, contempt coursing through her heart. William Tyr standing across the road, staring at her from a distance, his face betraying both suspicion and sorrow. Following Jonathan Tyr up the road, both of them young, no more than 10 or 11, but Kelsey's heart burned with hunger, the hunger to be someone special, a golden child in the eyes of the town. Jen Devlin's face beneath her, eyes bulging and cheeks turning purple as Kelsey throttled the woman, neither liking nor disliking the agonized confusion in Jen's eyes, only thinking that it was Jen's own fault for trusting, for thinking she meant well. Staring down at the pile of rough-cut sapphires in her hand, not sure what to do with them, not sure what she had accomplished, only that here, at last, was something that was hers. They crested the rise of the boulevard, and here was the keep lawn, but not as she had left it. There were more Mort here, scattered across the lawn and circling the keep. The drawbridge was down, and the gate appeared to have already fallen, but the bulk of the Mort were busily at work with a ram all the same. Several of them were trying to climb the keep's stone outer wall, aiming for the balconies on the third floor. "Where's the captain?" Corin shouted behind her. "Gone!" Elston shouted back. "He was with us on the boulevard, and then I don't know." Kelsey shook her head. She could not be bothered with Mace right now, or with any of them. She had business to tend to, for she had spotted something on the lawn below. A white tent, topped with a cross. If His Holiness had escaped the Arvath, so much the better. Her mind reached out to Ro Finn, looking for fire, the fire he had always controlled, and when she found it, she gasped in joy, watching the white tent go up, men's shrieks echoing through the fabric. The men on the walls were next. They toppled into the moat and disappeared, leaving only a widening pool of blood on top of the water. The men at the gate had oil, she saw now, and had been preparing to set fires themselves across the wide front expanse of her keep. She grabbed at the men's insides and yanked, smiling as blood sprayed across the lawn and their bodies fell where they stood.
"Lady! The captain!"
Elston's voice. Annoyed again, Kelsey turned and saw that he was pointing up the hill toward the entrance to the boulevard. The view struck a chord of memory in her, so clear that it was almost déjà vu. And she shivered, coming back to herself a bit, when,
"People of the Tearling!"
Had that been? At the entrance to the lawn, Mace was battling with 4 men in red cloaks. It was a day for memories. For a moment, Kelsey wondered whether they were back on the shores of the Cadell battling for their lives. A small form was beside Mace, tiny really, next to his bulk, battling as well. The tiny warrior's hood dropped, and she saw Andalai's daughter, Isha, trying to hold off 2 Caden with her knife. Her face was bright with fever, and her left arm dangled limply at her side. It was no contest. As Kelsey watched, one of the Caden grabbed her and broke her neck over his arm. Behind her, Kelsey heard a long shriek from the keep,
and a lie, but Kelsey could not trouble about her now. A third form was fleeing down the hill toward Kelsey and her guard, and the tide of violence inside Kelsey was momentarily muted as she recognized Father Tyler. Unreality washed over her again. The same sense of being half in a dream that she had experienced on and off ever since she had woken in her mother's house. Father Tyler had the look of a scarecrow. His filthy clothing hung off him like a sail. Mace covered his retreat, holding the four Caden off. Dyer and Kib had gone to help him, but there was no need for that. Kelsey could take care of the four cloaked men easily. She no longer feared the Caden. Or anyone else. "Get her inside!" Mace shouted. He left Dyer and Kib to it and came running down the hill, shepherding them all onward. Inside where? Kelsey wondered. But when she turned back to the keep, she saw that, by some miracle, the gate was open. Dead Mort lay strewn around the drawbridge and the lower lawn, and Kelsey could only marvel at the sight. Had she done that? No, of course not. It had been the Queen of Spades.
"Lady, run!"
Elston shouted, grabbing her arm, pointing to the top of the hill. Following his gaze, Kelsey felt real fear overtake her for the first time that day. The entrance to the great boulevard was crammed with children, a horde so vast that they were shoving and squeezing past each other to gain access. Like the little girl in the dungeon, they loped on all fours, and this made it easy to distinguish the tall figure on two legs who stood in their midst. Ro Finn, with pale white skin and glaring eyes. He had finally dispensed with his handsome face, and Kelsey had no power to stop him. She sensed a wall there. Surrounding him and the children, the same sort of shield the Red Queen had thrown up to defend her army below the new London walls.
"Come on, lady!"
Elston shouted again, and Kelsey allowed him to tug her down the lawn. Now she was running with a solid block of guards around her, and she did not see what became of Dyer or Kib or of the Caden.
"Majesty!"
Father Tyler panted beside her. Never in her life had she seen a man so ill-used, so close to collapse. He held out a thick strap, and Kelsey saw that he was still carrying his old satchel, though it looked considerably the worse for wear. Did he expect her to carry it for him? Now?
The old Kelsey would have carried it for him.
Carlin's voice mocked in her head, and Kelsey took the satchel, frowning.
"Thank God,"
Father Tyler said, tears pouring down his cheeks.
"Thank God."
She stared at him, confused, but they were pounding across the drawbridge now and through the gate. Mace caught up to them as they ran, and as soon as they were through, he began shouting orders, leading Kelsey around several piles of broken brick. She saw many faces. Andalai, white with horror as she clutched Glee in her arms, Devin, even Javel in the uniform of a gate guard. But there was no time to speak to anyone, for the guard was already hustling her down the hallway. Behind them, Kelsey could hear Rose's children still coming, a high-pitched screaming that seemed to be inside her head as well as without. Glancing backward, she saw that the corridor was covered with them. They swarmed over the gate guard, climbing the walls and ceiling, their movements sickening and insectile. Father Tyler's satchel bounced against Kelsey's leg, hurting her knee, but she couldn't give it back to him. The priest had been left behind.
"Here,"
Mace said, throwing open one of the many doors on the main hallway.
"Seal us inside."
He pushed Kelsey through, and she was relieved to see Penn, Elston, Ewan, Corrin, and Galen follow them inside. Mace slammed the door behind them.
"Bar the door!"
he shouted. Elston and Corrin put their shoulders to the door just as it began to shudder. Penn stood in front of Kelsey, sword in hand. She sank to the floor, blinking, and Father Tyler's satchel thudded to the ground beside her.
"Oh, God, Lazarus," she murmured. "How I failed."
"That's not you talking, lady," Mace grunted, shoving his shoulder against the pile of men holding the door closed. "Don't you get maudlin on me now."
"What else am I supposed to do?" she wanted to ask. Mace had chosen this room well. The door was thick oak, but it would not hold forever. The Queen of Spades was gone, and all that remained was Kelsey, who was not nearly so resilient. A great blow shook the door, and the room echoed with a moan of wounded wood. With nothing else to do, Kelsey opened Father Tyler's satchel and found two items: an old battered Bible and a large red box.
"Push, boys," Mace shouted. "Push for the Queen."
Another blow echoed off the door, but Kelsey barely heard it. She stared down at the polished cherry wood surface. She had seen this box before, in Katie's hands. It was nearly as old as the Tearling, but here it was. Flicking the latch, she opened it and stared down at the crown inside. Perfect in every detail, just as Katie had seen it. "He wanted to be a king," she thought. "That's all he ever wanted. And wouldn't I love to introduce him to the Queen of Spades? Oh, how I would love that!"
Boom!
Another great blow shook the doorframe, and several of her guard cried out at the impact. Corin flew backward. Brought back to herself, Kelsey picked up the crown, ignoring a weakly hectoring voice that seemed to travel through her fingers all the way to her brain.
"Don't you dare!"
And placed it on her head. Beyond the stone walls, she heard Roe Finn scream with rage. She had expected the crown to be heavy. It had felt so in the box. But it was light as air on her head. She felt its power travel through her, a line of current directly down to her chest, a pleasure so great that it was agonizing, making her close her eyes. She opened them and found herself in the cottage. But it was empty. She had always been able to tell, even upon waking, whether Barty and Carlin were home. Now she could sense their absence. Nothing moved in the rooms around her. Even the dust motes dancing in the light seemed lethargic, undisturbed. She was standing in the middle of Carlin's library. She felt years younger, 7 or 8 perhaps, as on those mornings when she used to come in here and curl up in Kelsey's patch and feel that all was right with the world. But Kelsey's patch was not here. In fact, the room held no furniture at all apart from the bookshelves. Carlin's books surrounded her on all sides, but not old and beaten, as so many of them had been in Kelsey's youth. These books looked brand new. Instinctively, Kelsey reached for one. She had not held a book in so long, and found that she had taken down The Bluest Eye. But when she opened the cover, the pages were blank. Alarmed, she pulled down another book, Something Wicked This Way Comes, and flipped through it. Nothing. Only a collection of empty pages.
"Carlin!" she called.
But there was no answer. Only the sleepiness of the empty cottage on a Sunday afternoon in her childhood. She used to love the times when Carlin was gone, when it was just her and Barty, and neither of them needed to look over his shoulder, anticipating disapproval. But at the sight of the blank books, she felt the cottage's familiar quiet tilting into nightmare. She took down Carlin's Shakespeare. Surely that bulwark of language was too indelible ever to be erased. But it was blank as well. In a panic now, Kelsey pulled down book after book, but they were all empty. It was only the semblance of a library, nothing more. Without words, the paper held no value. Carlin! She screamed.
She's not here.
Kelsey turned and found William Tyr standing behind her. His presence seemed quite reasonable, as things always did in dreams. Only the empty books were too awful to be true.
Why are they blank?
She asked.
I would guess because the future is undecided.
Tyr picked up two of the discarded books and placed them gently back on the shelves.
But I'm not sure. I never tried to dabble in the past.
Why not? Kelsey demanded. The pre-crossing, you could have gone back and changed it, couldn't you? Free will, the Emergency Powers Act?
It seemed easier to control the future by changing the present. The past is an unwieldy thing.
His words tugged at Kelsey's memory. Someone else had told her almost the same thing, hadn't they? Something about butterflies? It seemed decades ago.
You think I have no right to meddle with the past?
She asked.
I didn't say that. But you should be prepared for the decision to cost you.
I am prepared, Kelsey replied, not sure whether it was true. There's no other option. The Tyrling is wrecked.
The Tyrling, he murmured, his voice musing. I told them not to name things after me.
They didn't listen.
Kelsey looked around at the library, the empty cottage.
Why are we here?
To speak, child. I used to talk to my ancestors as well, though not in this place. We would go to Southport, to the promenade where I grew up. It used to scare me, seeing the prom so empty. But then I was younger than you.
Do you know who I am?
Kelsey asked. I know you're my blood, else I wouldn't be here. But are you Tyr or Finn?
Kelsey considered this question for a long moment, then admitted reluctantly,
I don't know. I don't think anyone does.
Why did you cast Ro off?
We didn't tell him. His mother was supposed to keep it a secret.
Why didn't you tell him?
I didn't know Sarah was pregnant until after the landing. I couldn't stay with her. Not once I knew that Lily was more than a vision. Sarah demanded that I choose. I chose Lily. And so lost my son.
But Ro knew.
Yes. She was a weak woman, Sarah, and Ro a consummate manipulator. She never kept anything from him for long.
You were proud of him. Tyr frowned, troubled.
I was proud of his potential, but I foresaw ruin.
Ruin is upon us, Kelsey pressed. Can you not help?
What is your name, child?
Kelsey Glynn.
Glynn. I don't know that name. I see that you have many stories to tell, and I would like to know what became of our town, but I sense that your time is short. Come.
He led her out of the library and down the cottage's tiny front hallway. Everywhere Kelsey saw items she remembered. Carlin's silver candlesticks, the vase that Kelsey had chipped when she was 12, the shoe stand that Barty had carved to hold their boots. but there were no candles in the sticks, no boots in the rack, and the vase was brand new. Tyr opened the front door and beckoned her on. Following him, Kelsey expected to see the same raked patch of dirt that had always fronted the cottage, but when she stepped outside, she gasped and clapped her hands to her ears. They were in a howling tunnel. Kelsey's skin buffeted by wind that seemed to blow in all directions. She was reminded of the tunnels from Lily's memory. Fast cars and deafening sound, but this tunnel was empty, no cars or people. Instead of the concrete walls of Lily's time, Kelsey saw the tunnel as a broad vista. People and places, all of them constantly in motion. Her vision seemed to stretch for miles. "What is this?"
"Time," said Tyr beside her. "Past, present, future."
"Which is which?" Kelsey asked, looking right and left. She could not distinguish the scenes before her.
"It is all one," Tyr replied. "The past controls the future. Is that not why you're here?"
Kelsey's gaze fixed on one scene, and she walked down the empty tunnel to have a look at it. A small room, with wooden floors and stone walls. A group of men were holding the door closed with all of their might, and behind them, on the floor, a woman sat cross-legged, her eyes closed, her bowed head circled with a crown. As Kelsey watched, a crack appeared in the door, and the wood began to split.
"Very little time," Tyr repeated. "You could go back there, or you could choose something else."
But Kelsey was already searching, reading the scenes in front of her faster than she had ever read any book. So much time here. And there was. But it was Kelsey's time. For in the seemingly infinite number of scenes before her, there was nothing she did not recognize. She saw the shipment rolling through the Almont, 9 long cages snaking their way toward Mort Main. She saw the white ship going down in its terrible storm. Great God, if she could only have prevented that. Saw President Freewell standing behind a podium. Saw a much younger William Tyr jumping from an airplane. Saw Lily watching in tears as her younger sister was marched down the hall by 4 men in black uniforms. On and on it went. And now Kelsey saw scenes even more distant, further and further back, to a time without cars or electricity or even books. It frightened her, the howling emptiness of that world, most of humanity locked into a bare struggle for survival. She didn't want to go back there. She turned her attention to the future, but what she found there was even more terrifying. She would die in the keep, torn apart by rose creatures. They would be a constant torment to humanity, but one day they would be eradicated when someone invented an inoculation. Kelsey's vision broadened, and she saw the Tyrling hundreds of years along, a despotic kingdom that had built on Kelsey's legacy and extended its dominance into empire, the entire new world under Tyr control. This new Tyrling was no better than Mort Main, bloated with its own power and driven by a sense of superiority so well-honed that it bordered on manifest destiny. And that made perfect sense. The danger of empire, after all, lay in the character of emperors.
"Choose quickly," Tyr said, his voice dispassionate.
Kelsey looked back and found that Rose's children were on her guard, moving faster than their blades could follow. One of them finally succeeded in toppling Mace, biting into his shoulder. Kelsey felt a crack open inside her, wide and deep, and she clamped her mouth shut to keep from wailing in grief. Pen went next, his sword no use against the creatures that swarmed his ankles and pulled him down. Within a few seconds, the woman with the bowed head was left unguarded, and they swarmed toward her.